Thank you, Judge. The next case this morning is 18-1296, United States v. Jumaev.
Well, thank you. Before commencing argument, the panel decided not to live stream these cases because the discussion could inadvertently lead to a discussion of classified information. That would not be the intent, of course, of the court or counsel, but if it happens, we would want to have an opportunity to redact those references prior to making the argument available as customary under our court procedures for recording these arguments. So the argument will appear promptly following the conclusion of the arguments on our website. On the other hand, in this case, if there are inadvertent discussions of such information, we'll have an opportunity for counsel for the government or for the defense to assert to us a claim of privilege with respect to any such information, and we'll consider it at that time. Thank you, counsel. We're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Caleb Kruckenberg for Bakhtiyor Jumaev. It took the government 6 years and one day to bring Mr. Jumaev to trial, but he spent the entire time in pretrial detention. On his first day of the jury trial, Mr. Jumaev had already served a sentence at the mid-range of the ultimate guideline range of 63 to 78 months. And the primary reason that the matter was delayed was the government's failure to disclose exculpatory evidence that was in his possession. In fact, the government had more than 39,000 files of recorded conversations between Mr. Jumaev and Mr. Mutarov, which contained admittedly exculpatory evidence, but which was not disclosed to the defense until 2016.
Wasn't September 1, 2016 the discovery deadline?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the discovery deadline that the district court set.
Did Mr. Jumaev object to the discovery deadline?
He did, Your Honor. And at the status conference where the court decided the September 1st, 2016 discovery deadline, counsel for both defendants objected to the delayed discovery disclosures and also the late trial deadline of March of 2017.
I wasn't asking about the trial deadline. I was asking about the discovery deadline. It was set more than 4 years after he was charged, but did he object to that?
Yes, Your Honor. And it was on October 21st, excuse me, going back, I'm sorry, this is a very voluminous record, as I'm sure you're well aware. At the July 13th status conference, the court set the discovery deadline of September 1st, 2016, and counsel objected. Counsel objected to the slow pace that it's taking the government to disclose this information to us and to the September 1st discovery deadline. And this is part of a larger pattern. Defense counsel for both defendants was consistent throughout this proceeding that this was taking too long. There were numerous motions filed well before the September 1st, 2016 deadline, objecting to the slow pace of disclosure, objecting to the fact that no transcripts had been released. Defense counsel was aware all along that Mr. Jumaev and Mr. Mutarov's own statements had been recorded. That was in the possession of the government. They had started recording as early as 2008, and that was never disclosed. That wasn't disclosed until 2016. And there's simply no way that defense counsel could move forward to trial when they don't even have their own client's statements. I mean, this isn't even a Brady obligation. This is just a simple disclosure obligation. But I think it's even more important because the government later acknowledged that among the 2016 disclosures there was Brady material. They referred to it as Brady material. And as time went on, additional disclosures were made, and the government continuously sort of eked out these other disclosures. I mean, notably, there were tremendously important disclosures about Dr. Kakberdiev, who was the government's translator and the principal translator the government relied on to go through these recordings. It turned out that he did not speak Uzbek and Tajik, which were the languages that he was translating. And he was ultimately fired by the FBI after he failed a polygraph examination. The government withheld this information for years. This was only disclosed until, in 2017. And that was at the insistence, that was after an order by the district court to disclose this information and disclose the questions.
Counsel?
Yes.
I'm just curious, did the court allow you a defense budget for interpreters, for you to hire your own interpreters?
Yes, Your Honor. We did have a budget to hire interpreters, but part of the problem was the cumbersome way that defense counsel had to reconstruct these recordings. So we had over 39,000 recordings disclosed in 2016. That was over 1,800 hours of conversation. And what we found out in discovery is that these were from microphones placed in Mr. Jumaev's house at various places. And so there was some overlap, but there was no index. There was no, we did not have any kind of meaningful way to differentiate what those recordings had. And of course, they were all in a mix of Tajik and Uzbek. And so we had to hire our own experts and our own translators to go through that information in incredibly laborious process. And then, as defense counsel noted at the trial level, in 2017, when the government filed its superseding indictment with counts 5 and 6 related to new allegations about Sheikh Bahori and alleged actions taken by my client with his son, that meant that the defense had to go back through all of that information that we had already reviewed in this very laborious process, because we had no idea that this was the basis of a new charge or that there was now going to be these charges. And that
charges that ultimately didn't go forward, correct?
They didn't go forward. And the reason they didn't go forward is because they were based on a lie. And this is a falsehood that the government has acknowledged. Special Agent Hale testified falsely, and that's the word used by the government in its appellate brief in this case, that Sheikh Bahori said, my client said a line to his son, something about there's still one bullet left in this conflict. We know that that was a fabrication. We know that that was not said by my client, and that was at best a phony or a false translation. And we didn't find that out until 2017. And certainly the government's intention before that information was disclosed was to go forward to trial on counts 5 and 6.
Counsel, can I just ask a more general question about the relationship between the discovery in the case and your speedy trial claim? The defendants ask for broad discovery in the first place? In other words, isn't it inconsistent to ask for broad discovery? Turns out 39,000 recordings and so forth, and then complain about receiving voluminous discovery in return. I mean, the very request for this much information is going to delay for some time the ability for you to get the information and to process it. So why attribute the reason for delay? It seems like you're saying it's all the government, but you asked for this.
Well, Your Honor, obviously the defense is entitled to Mr. Jumaev's own statements. And
absolutely. I'm not suggesting that you weren't entitled to the discovery, but given the nature of the case and the evidence collected, if you want all the evidence and you want the government to produce it all and translate it all and then go through it, that's going to take time. So, wasn't the defense at least somewhat responsible for the delay in making all this happen?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think it's chargeable to the defense for us to ask for the evidence that we are automatically entitled to, which is the statements of our own client.
But is it chargeable to the government that it's going to take them some time to get it to you?
Well, and under the speedy trial analysis, certainly that's something that this court has to consider. But there's a difference between...
Well, no, it's not a matter of considering. I'm asking if it should count. In other words, you're asking for all these recordings, and the government ultimately turns them over, but as they've indicated, there were translation challenges, enormous translation challenges here. Should they be charged with the delay when there's so much material, not only in volume, but in terms of translating them? Where does that fall in the speedy trial calculus?
Well, Your Honor, the government started recording this information and collecting this information in 2008, and it recorded it from 2008 to 2011. When it was ultimately disclosed to the defense in 2016, it was not translated. We didn't have transcripts. They gave us the files. And certainly, we don't expect them to instantly be able to give us that information. But the delay between 2011, when it was collected, my client was arrested in 2012, and then we didn't get it for another 4 years. That is chargeable to the government. And I'll also note, at a discovery conference, a status conference, very early in the case, the government estimated it could disclose these recordings as early as that summer, in June of 2013.
I just want to be clear on one point. So when did the government make arrangements and actually have the material translated? When did that happen?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding from the record is that there were certain tech cuts that were provided to the defense throughout the process, where certain recordings, we got summary translations, most of those provided by Dr. Kakberdiev, based on his review of the recordings. We got these tech cuts before we even got the recordings. In September of 2016, that's when we got the raw recordings, all 39,000.
Counsel, so that I could have a basis here, what was the date of the request?
For the initial...
Your counsel, your client's statements. The defendant's statements.
That was the initial request. Well, I certainly have one that was written in the record on February 6, 2015. There was a joint motion for all of the defendant's statements. And I believe there was an oral request at a status conference in October of 2012.
So the first request for the defendant's statements was made 3 years after he was charged?
And, Your Honor, those are the notes I have in front of me.
I understand, and you can supplement these if you'd like, but I just like some basic dates here. The date of the request was February 6, 2015?
There was a written request on February 6, 2015, Your Honor.
What was the date of the charge?
Mr. Jumayev was arrested on March 12th of 2012.
So 3 years later, the defense gets around to asking for the statements, all statements made by the defendant.
Well, Your Honor, there was also an October 11th, 2012 status conference. And that is when there was the discussion about the disclosures of the recordings. And the government said... It indicated that it hoped to complete these disclosures by June of 2013.
Well, did they represent that they would provide them at that time? Had a request been made at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe there was a request on the record at that hearing that my clients be
Well, we're far past the state of beliefs here. Was a request made for the subject information at the 2012 status conference?
And, Your Honor, I do not have that information in front of me. I can find that out and submit the record.
I can't believe that. You're arguing this case. It's a principal purpose of the argument, and you can't tell us whether a request was made at that status conference? And you're going to have to tell us at some point later?
Your Honor, I cannot confidently represent one way or the other about that status conference.
All right. Well, then it's hard, seems to me, you can hardly squawk about a 3-year delay if you can't even assert to us that you requested the information.
Well, Your Honor,
or
certainly
cite to us a rule under which you were automatically entitled to it as a manner of mandated government disclosure pursuant to rule.
Well, Your Honor, so there are two issues there. First of all, these were the statements of my clients, and so they were subject to disclosure by the government. There were also Brady materials.
Under what rule?
Your Honor, under the Rule 16 disclosures, my client was entitled to recordings of his own statements.
Does the rule provide time for that disclosure?
It does not have a hard and fast time, Your Honor, but certainly when the request has been made, which it was, and it was in writing at least by September of 2015, there was the request for those statements. As soon as we found out those existed, we made that request. And additionally, as we've argued, there's a significant amount of Brady material, and obviously that's sort of a colloquial term, but there's exculpatory evidence in the government's possession, which it acknowledged, which it did not disclose. And there's an independent constitutional requirement for them to disclose that at a reasonable time. And part of the delay here was that information was not disclosed. It was not disclosed until years into the proceedings. And as I've mentioned before, part of this is Dr. Kakberdiev, part of this is with the counts 5 and 6 of the superseding indictment. But that's not all. I mean, there was also evidence about confidential informants. We had the deposition in 2017 when we had a witness who we did not know he had received material immigration benefits until the day of the deposition. And that led once again to Judge Kane ordering sanctions based on the late disclosure. And certainly when we're talking about the speedy trial issue, it's not that necessarily that there was a Brady violation. It's just that without that evidence, my client could not have gone to trial. If Mr. Jumayev,
I am sympathetic to the defense argument that a 6-year delay in bringing a case to trial is an unreasonable delay. I'm sympathetic to that argument, but I'm also a realist, and I expect defense counsel to act in a propitious and timely manner in the persecution of a defense. And that's why I asked whether you asked for this information in a timely manner. So you can hardly ask us to charge the government with 3 years of delay when you didn't even make the request. So that's why I say, did you make a request at the status conference of 2012? That seems to be a material question that you should be able to answer. I'm sorry to come back to it and beat you up a bit on it, but I think you deserve it if you can't answer that question. So let's chalk off 3 years of delay and while we decide whether you did or didn't ask for that information. After 2015, when did you finally get this, what you describe as a dump, and I think could be fairly described instead as a production of the information that you requested.
That was initially disclosed on September 1st, 2016. And that's when the 39,000 files were released. The government continued to make disclosures, though, well into 2017 and 2018. And part of our argument, and I think part of the reason why we're suggesting that even in 2016 we couldn't go to trial, or we couldn't go to trial at the original trial date, is the government continued to disclose new information that it acknowledged was Brady material. That was in 2017 and into 2018 as well. And all of those disclosures that I referenced earlier, with Dr. Kakberdiev, his qualifications, that was in late 2017. I believe that was October 2017. There was the deposition in Kazakhstan that was around Christmas of 2017. We also got additional disclosures about the false statements, the false testimony about the one bullet left line that led to the ultimate dismissal of counts 5 and 6. And we also got information that there was false testimony in front of the grand jury by an FBI agent about when the investigation originated. All of those came out in 2017 and 2018. And certainly those were important pieces of evidence.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a couple of other questions relating to the Barker, the second factor under the Barker test, which are the reasons for the delay. Let me just start by asking about Mr. Dumayev having joined in filing the Section 702 motions, even though the Section 702 FISA notice that was filed in 2013 didn't apply to him. Why didn't that prolong the proceedings against him?
Well, Your Honor, because that didn't have anything to do with the disclosures.
I'm not asking about that. We're asking now about whether Dumayev sort of hanging on to participation in an issue that the government said didn't apply to him. The government in their brief says that he was, quote, far more interested in litigating FISA-related issues than in proceeding expeditiously towards trial. Why isn't that correct?
Well, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. And part of that is because at the same time, we were litigating the discovery issue.
No. Counsel, you're not answering the question about sticking around for the FISA 702 issue when it didn't apply to him. Why didn't that prolong the proceedings against your client?
I don't think it did prolong the proceedings, I guess is what I'm trying to answer your question.
Well,
why
do that? Why continue to file motions and participate on an issue that didn't apply to him?
Well, I think initially, Mr. Dumayev didn't know whether it did or not, and
but the notice didn't go to him. Yet you had notice in 2013.
Well, and that, Your Honor, is a tactical decision by trial counsel. And we have not continued to litigate that on appeal. We don't believe that's a live issue anymore. The best I can say, I think, is that trial counsel, because at that point we didn't have the information, we didn't have the recordings, and I think there was an effort to file the motion sort of prophylactically and make sure that we did not waive an issue that turned out was important or did affect our client.
All right. Let me move to another question. The Sixth Amendment speedy trial violation challenge was filed for the first time in February 2017, 5 years after he was charged. Why doesn't that weaken your position that there was a timely assertion of the speedy trial right? You've been complaining about, you know, the charge was in 2012. You didn't get it. You didn't get anything until 2016, and then things continued. But you didn't even raise this issue until 2017.
And Your Honor, obviously, that is a factor. That is part of the equitable analysis. But I will note, defense counsel made two formal motions. And just because it's now 5 years when he filed the first motion to dismiss, and then it was 6 years when he filed the second motion, I think the courts recognize, and the case law recognizes, that the longer this goes on, the worse it is, and the worse of the constitutional problem. And frankly, in a case like this, where it is complicated, or at least with the discovery disclosures, there's a difference between it being 2 years. But once we're talking about 5 years, it is an important assertion of the right to say, this has taken far too long. The other argument that I would just make, Your Honor, is that defense counsel did object to the slow pace of the proceedings on multiple instances. But
defense counsel also didn't oppose, I think, 7 of 8 tolling motions under the Speedy Trial Act.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think there was a recognition by defense counsel that this isn't a normal case in the sense right. that it could be tried in a year.
But by the way, combine that with the fact that your client filed 50 substantive motions. Why wouldn't that prolong the case?
Well, because it didn't prolong the case in the sense that doesn't have anything to do with the government's disclosures. The government still didn't make
its disclosures. But it does have something to do with how long it's going to take. You're going to the district judge and filing 50 motions, 10 substantial discovery motions, and it's going to take time to litigate that.
It is, Your Honor, but
why doesn't that time count? Doesn't that count against you in terms of the reason for delay? It's not that I'm not saying that you shouldn't file the motions. Maybe it was necessary to defend the case, but those things inherently take time.
Yes, Your Honor, but all of that was complete, and that was complete before we're even talking about the disclosures. And if Mr. Jumayev had not made those motions, then he would have been in exactly the same situation. The trial would have happened at the same
time. Wait, one second. Are you telling Judge Matheson that all of the substantive motions about which he's inquiring had been resolved prior to September the 1st of 2016?
No, Your Honor. And I want to be very clear about that. My reference there, I think, is to the FISA motions. Those were resolved. There were outstanding matters, obviously, and there were outstanding discovery issues that went well into 2017 and 2018.
Well, I thought Judge Matheson's question was making a distinction between discovery matters and substantive matters, motions, that is.
Well, and specifically with respect to the discovery motions, part of the problem was that the government wasn't providing appropriate discovery and providing appropriate exculpatory information. On the one hand, I mean, the government is essentially blaming Mr. Jumayev for asking for Brady material to which he's entitled, and then saying, well, it's his fault because he asked for it, when in reality he could not have gone to trial more quickly until he got that Brady material, and we found out that information was exculpatory information. It was disclosed late. It was disclosed in 2018.
Was counsel for the defendant appointed counsel at all times?
Yes, Your Honor.
On a compensatory basis?
Yes, Your Honor. And Your Honor, I would just like to reserve the remaining time I have for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hear from the government.
It please the court. Jim Murphy representing the United States. I first want to address the speedy trial issue raised by Mr. Jumayev, and Mr. Mutaroff adopted most of those arguments. And if the court has questions about Mr. Mutaroff, I'm prepared to address those also. There's a first order of business, however, I want to make very clear that the government never stated and never agreed that Special Agent Hale lied. He did not lie. He did not knowingly testify falsely. He was relying, in the instance the defense counsel is referring to, on a report by Dr. Kekberdiev that said Mr. Jumaev had made a statement about sending his son to the cause and there is yet one bullet left for the cause. A defense interpreter went through the same statement and said, well, I don't think that's right. And we're dealing with either the Uzbek or Tajik languages, which Special Agent Hale did not read or speak.
Are there any cases out there you can cite us to in which appellate courts in this country have ruled that a delay in excess of 6 years in bringing a case to trial is not a speedy trial violation?
Yes, there is one.
Could you tell us those cases, please?
Well, we cited in our brief.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I apologize. It doesn't come immediately to mind. But there is a case.
One case.
It was from this circuit where the delay was actually, I may be wrong about that. It could be the Second Circuit, but where the delay was 6 years or more. But the critical thing is the complexity of the case and the justification for the delay.
Counsel, I've read over and over ad nauseum in the government's brief about the fact that this is a complicated case. Well, let's spot you that. The case is complicated. You knew that going in, correct?
Correct.
You knew that when the case was charged, correct?
Absolutely.
Is the fact that a case is complicated in and of itself a basis for delaying a case to trial of 6 years?
When the case is based upon voluminous interceptions, many of which are classified information, yes, that's a very good reason because of the requirements.
So you would have us rule. You would have us rule that in cases that involve classified information and cases of this type, that as a matter of routine, a 6 year delay in bringing a case to trial is okay because the case is, quote, complicated.
I certainly would not argue that, Your Honor. It's a case by case analysis, and this court needs to look at who was responsible for the delay.
Well, counsel, under the rule, you're required to provide a defendant's statement to the defense as a matter of course. So you knew that going into the case at the time that it was charged in 2012. And yet, 4 years later, you provide information that you're required by rule to provide. I'm not sympathetic to the defense who can't even tell me whether they asked at the status conference or cite to me statements or requesting that information. But so I'm not rah-rahing defense counsel here. I think it's terrible that they can't tell us that. But assuming that they didn't and that you were just required by rule to provide it, why should we excuse a 4 year delay in providing information required by rule?
Judge Lucero, the majority of discovery, trial relevant discovery in this case, including the defendant's statements, was traditional FISA, and it was turned over long before 2016. 2016 was the deadline for what we call 702 derived FISA information. And it has to go through a declassification procedure that is not simple. And the reason it was as late as 2016, which I agree is somewhat late considering the indictment was 2012, is because we spent a great deal of time litigating discovery. One motion by the defense, and I don't fault them for filing it, but one motion by the defense, a motion to suppress the 702 evidence, which Mr. Jumaev, as the court knows, had no standing to do, consumed well over 2 years. Government said,
with respect to the 702 evidence, is it correct, with respect to Mr. Mutarov, that it took the government 2 years to notify him that it was going to rely on 702 evidence?
No, it didn't take that long. Our note, our second FISA notice on 702 was filed in October of 2013.
So it is not correct that, that it took them two.
It wasn't 2 years. The government filed its first.
It's almost 2 years, wasn't it? Well, however long it is.
Well, it was slightly less, but
well, however long it is, why should it be delayed at all? The government knows what it has. It's filed the traditional FISA evidence notice. Why wouldn't you just file the 702 notice at the same time?
Well, there are reasons for that. I don't think it was altogether clear at the time that the government was required to do that. This is not a black and white matter. There are reasons for it, but although the court may not care for this explanation, I really don't think it contributed significantly to the delay, considering the total delay in the case, filing our second notice in October 2013. Ultimately, that really didn't contribute to delay. It's not like discovery had come to a stop, Your Honors. Discovery was progressing continuously on traditional FISA material, which is the bulk of the trial relevant evidence. A lot of that stuff that was disclosed in 2016 was duplicative or administrative data, and the prosecutor represented this to the court. I am sensitive to the fact that this is almost 4 years later, and it is significant, but the government was not able to release some of that information and go through the declassification process until it had a ruling on a suppression motion on the 702 evidence.
Could you, counsel, just give us, you rely a lot on challenges encountered in the translation process in your brief, but could you give us an explanation of what those challenges were and when the translation work was done?
The translation work was done more or less continuously from around the time of the indictment. I will admit I don't personally know the exact dates. Again, a good deal of it focused on traditional FISA material, which was litigated fairly promptly.
Is there anything in the record that indicates that counsel for the defense was asserting a speedy trial objections prior to the time that they filed their first written motion?
We try and deal with this in some detail in the brief, Judge Lucero. They did make some, they made statements along the lines of, well, this case needs to move ahead, Your Honor. And Mr. Krockenberg mentioned some of these things. That's true. I mean, that's an understandable statement. But at the same time, they were saying, well, this case really needs to move on. The particular statement I'm recalling where they said that was litigation where they were fighting the government over a protective order that the government wanted to keep classified information from coming out. And they did that over and over and over and over again. They fought the government at every opportunity, and although they had the right to do that, I don't think they now have the right to step back and say, why did it take so long? The reason the case was dragging on.
Did the government assist in expediting the designation of counsel to receive classified information in order to facilitate the effort?
These counsel never had that designation.
Was it requested?
I can't remember if the defense counsel, I don't think they requested it. It takes a while to get cleared for that, and I don't think these defense counsel had the background for it. To the best of my knowledge, that was never requested. But we had to go to the district judge to declassify some of the stuff we had.
All right. On that same similar vein, I was hoping to be able to review Judge Kane's confidential order on or the classified aspect of his order regarding the reasons for his ruling against the motion to dismiss for lack of a speedy trial. Was such an order entered, and is it in the record for our review?
Referring now to the classified file, correct?
Yes.
And you just want to know if it exists.
You don't need to tell me to disclose classified information.
I understand. You're just asking if it exists.
I just want to know if the order is there. If an order was entered of that nature, and if it's in the record.
Does the record, I apologize, does the record indicate there is such a classified?
I can't answer that question.
Nothing comes immediately to mind. Although I'm familiar with some of the information, I am not the principal author of, say, the government's classified brief filed in this court. If I knew, I would say, I don't know, Judge Lucero, if Judge King issued a classified order. I do recall we had some issues trying to reconstruct matters from his chambers, because there were so many CIPA Section 4 hearings and other classified proceedings, and the office put in a considerable amount of work trying to reconstruct what happened in Judge Kane's. I don't mean that critically.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like we had a docket sheet the way we would have in district court with unclassified information. That would have been helpful, even if it was a classified docket sheet. We didn't have anything like that. People had to go in and try and reconstruct stuff, and we had to take things over there. And we did the same thing with this court when it requested classified information. We were trying to help reconstruct the record. This took some time. I wish I could give you a better answer. I just don't know.
That's fine. That's fine. We'll figure it out.
Counsel, I'm sorry to return to this, but I didn't think the answer was complete. To what extent is the government relying on the difficulty in doing the translation to justify the length of time it took to get this case to trial?
It was one of many significant factors. First, the statements and interceptions have to be translated. Then, if they're going to be declassified, and we agreed to that with some and we objected to that with others, then there's the process, the declassification process. We have to get permission from Washington. All of this takes a while. Yes, the translation issues were highly significant. Not only did we need translators in Uzbek and Tajik, we needed security cleared translators. Those were somewhat hard to come by. And so, yes, I would say it was very significant.
Isn't it? I understand. Maybe I can't fully understand, but I can begin to understand how challenging that task must have been. But isn't it the government's responsibility to devote the resources necessary to do that task in a timely way? Why should Mr. Jumaev be sitting in jail waiting for that to happen for this length of time? Why shouldn't that delay be attributed to the government in a speedy trial analysis? Just seems to me your argument is, it was really hard to get everything translated, and I'm sure it was. But even so, why shouldn't that delay be charged to you in terms of the Barker factors?
Because it does not reflect fault on the part of the government, Judge Matheson. It is a characteristic of this terrorism case. And most of the, a great number of translations and the majority of trial relevant evidence derived from interceptions in Tajik, Uzbek, and Russian were turned over fairly promptly and litigated. There was a suppression motion on that too, and that was litigated fairly promptly. The government was being diligent. The prosecutor met regularly, provided monthly updates on this information. Now, I don't recall too many disputes early in the case on traditional FISA. Most of the disputes would arise later after this lengthy delay of more than 2 years over attempts to suppress Section 702-derived FISA. And again, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but they had every right to file that motion. But, Your Honors, there are two roads in litigation. There's the quick road where counsel says, well, I don't want to, let's dispense with motions or most of them. My client wants a trial. He wants it now. He doesn't want to be in jail. That's one way to go. That can work.
Counsel,
they didn't take that road.
I just think, counsel, that that is a naive argument. I mean, the government has. You may respectfully disagree, but the government has the resources to conduct a case properly, to do certain aspects of the case at the same time that they're doing others. So for you to say, oh, well, we had to resolve these motions before we could get over to the issue of translation, it just doesn't, I mean, it's a non-argument. I mean, surely you could do both things at the same time.
We were doing both things at the same time. With all due respect, Judge Lucero, I think you're overstating our position a bit. I can understand frustration with the length of time it took. It took too long. There's no question. The question is why it took that long. And we can't change the fact that the case derived from wire interceptions under FISA and that they were in languages like Uzbek and Tajik, and we need security clear translators. A great deal of that proceeded very expeditiously. The hang-up was a Section 702 material, which, as we all know,
part of that hang-up is 2 years in telling the defendants about it. So 2 years of it is chargeable to the government.
No, it's defense motion.
Not, as you said before, not 2 years, almost 2 years.
Well, the government, if you're referring to the government's second FISA notice, yes, that was October. But Judge Kane took under consideration the defense suppression motion for nearly 2 years. And I don't recall any protests from the defense about that, although I don't know that I fault them for it. It's a delicate situation to demand a ruling from a judge. But still, it was their motion. It was a very complicated motion. It involved matters of national security. There is little precedent today, but more than there was then. And Judge Kane was faced with some very difficult issues on whether or not 702 was constitutional. There is somewhat more authority, and that will be addressed in the Musharraf argument to come. But I can understand why he hesitated over that motion, but that's not the government's fault, Your Honor. It really isn't. And although again, the defense had every right to file that in every other motion, but they can't have it both ways.
Well, under the Baker principles, who do we charge a 2 year time period for on the part of the trial court to rule on a motion?
I don't think either party is at fault for it.
Well, we can't simply say it doesn't.
You can't blame us for a judge sitting on a motion for 2 years, Judge.
That's right. If we take 2 years to decide a case, it's on us. It's not on counsel. But it nevertheless, let me put the question this way. You argue on the matter of prejudice, that the defendant was not prejudiced. And my question to you is very simple. Should we presume prejudice when a defendant is incarcerated for a period of 6 years? Is that in and of itself prejudicial?
Absolutely not. Not in this case. The case law is very clear that in assessing whether or not a defendant needs to show prejudice, and 6 years, it can be a threshold for that, I concede. It is only the delay chargeable to the government that can be considered. Case law is very clear on that, and it's set out in our briefs. And the six-year delay was not in any way attributable entirely to the government.
What portion of the 6 years is attributable to the government in your book?
Judge, are you looking for a confession? I'm sorry.
No, I
apologize.
No, that's quite all right.
There were some proceedings in 2017 The government superseded the indictment in May of 2016. Well, it seemed reasonable at the time. Subsequent developments that the government did not have at the time cast doubt on the government's theory for those counts. They were the ones pertaining to Mr. Jumaev's son. Dr. Kekberdiev was fired by the FBI following an inconclusive polygraph, and another government expert testified that he wasn't altogether sure that some of the way the government was interpreting what Sheikh Bukhari and his madrasa were doing was altogether as bad as the government thought. And so trial was approaching. Things had already taken too long. Things were very complicated, and the government voluntarily dismissed counts 5 and 6, which ended the issue. It was no longer a trial issue. Dr. Kekberdiev was not a trial issue, and that was that. Now, it was very reasonable for the government to do this at the time, and the government doesn't have a crystal ball, as you know, and we didn't know that a year, 2 years later, evidence would surface that cast at least a shadow over the government's theory, and the government decided, well, we're not going to pursue this. We're just going to focus on what we have. So certainly below, the trial court was not happy, and the defense was not happy with the government adding counts in 2016. Perhaps part of that is on us. But again, the government did not have the information at the time that it would later acquire about Kekberdian and one of its own experts, Steinberg, about Sheikh Bukhari. That would develop later. The passage of time gave rise to new discovery. Judge Kane made an observation about that. Apart from that, I don't think I'm willing to own up to anything, Judge Lucero. Again, the 2016 is a...
Thank you for your counsel.
Yeah.
Counsel, what do the cases teach us about a situation where there is a motion pending and the district court does not decide it for an extended period of time? And it's not the government's fault. It's not the defendant's fault. It's just that there's a lengthy delay because the motion is pending. And I'm speaking to the Sixth Amendment speedy trial, not the Speedy Trial Act. But does that delay, do we just overlook that period of time? Or it's still, the delay is still real for the defendant. So how are courts supposed to concede trial?
To the extent it's chargeable to anyone, with all due respect, I think it's on the defense. They chose to litigate an issue of first impression, if not first, one of which little precedent existed on the constitutionality of Section 702 and related issues. As I mentioned, there's some authority for that now. There was little then, and Judge Kane, I think, was understandably concerned that he was going to have to issue a ruling with national implications on an intelligence gathering statute. But it resulted from the motion itself, and it's part of the defense strategy to actively litigate pretty much every issue that they could concerning intelligence gathering, government surveillance techniques, and related information. So the delay did result from the defense motion and our defense strategy that they were going to use this litigation as a forum to contest these matters and potentially, from their point of view, create favorable law. They were important issues. There was no question. They were very interesting issues. But still, as I've indicated, there are two roads. If you're going to take the slow road and litigate these issues of national importance and about 100 other issues, I don't think you can then complain, because I think ultimately the delay is attributable to the defense motion. And I think that the courts pondering this very carefully is completely understandable for a district judge, faced with a decision that could have national implications.
Counsel, a couple of quick questions on the sentence. How much time did the defendant serve, if you pardon the expression, prior to the announcement of sentence, and what was the sentence relative to that time?
I recall Judge Kane sentenced Mr. Jumaev to time served. He received a very lenient sentence. That wasn't exactly what you asked, I know. But the court rejected a terrorism enhancement that would have dramatically increased the sentence.
It was roughly 6 years, some, is that correct?
I think it was 78 months. Is my recollection, Mr. Krockenberg, I remember it. I think it was 78
months. He served 78 and he was sentenced 78, is that correct?
At the time of sentencing, yeah. Yes.
So my question is this. In assessing the speedy trial issue, should we consider the fact that the sentence was equivalent to the time served awaiting trial?
No, Your Honor. Fourth Amendment doesn't protect against alleged sentencing prejudice. And the defense argument that this has some relevance, I think, is far-fetched. Judge Kane spent a great deal of time with the 3553A factors. He also considered you just went away, Judge Lucero.
I'm having issue with the sun in my eye, so I'm just blocking the video for a moment. But I'm here, and don't worry about it.
All right. Judge Kane carefully reviewed the 3553A factors. He also expressed some personal sympathy for Jumaev, who, rightly or wrongly, he felt was acting out of, this is pretty much a quote, a sense of ethnic and religious identification. The government would strenuously see things differently when you're supporting terrorism. I don't think that matters. That goes to the motive. Not you're still supporting a terrorist group resulting in the death of people around the world. But nonetheless, Judge Kane saw it that way. But that was the basis of his sentence. It wasn't just that he happened to have been locked up that long by the time of sentencing. And I say 78 months because that's the best I can do. I think it was somewhere in that range. Have I answered your question, Judge Lucero? I can't hear Judge Lucero now. Are you there, Judge Lucero? I hope he's all right.
I think he may have his mute button on.
He is still on the call, judges.
I'm here.
Okay.
Sorry. Here, I got this. I've got it resolved. Thank you.
This technology is very awkward. I would much prefer to be in.
Sorry about that.
So, counsel, with the clock ticking down, if the starting point were, wait a minute, we have 6+ years between the charge and the trial, which in the landscape of Speedy Trial Act challenges, that seems to be a pretty extreme length of time. And if we just work backward from that, if you just had to state the essence of your argument, what is it?
The essence of my argument, and to respond to a central theme of the reply briefing, is that the disclosure by the government, and this is the essence of my argument relating to the briefing, the disclosures by the government in 2016 were not because the government was holding on to Brady material and just wouldn't give it up. It was because the what is Brady has to be determined by the court. This was classified information. The government has ex parte proceedings and goes to the court and presents it and may argue that it can't be disclosed even under Rule 16. The court has to make a decision. Is this Brady or is it not? Or is it otherwise discoverable? To do that, Judge Kane met ex parte with the defense lawyers. There is nothing wrong with that. That's the way the system worked. He needed to know what their defenses were to figure out whether or not certain information really needed to be disclosed. He was doing that regularly throughout 2017 and early 2018. That is why the government was turning over this information, not because it was sitting on it all these years, but because we needed a determination from the court that this material was going to be discoverable. The government didn't want all of it to be given up. And by the way, almost everything that in the briefing that Jumaev complains about, particularly in his opening brief on labeled sanctions, is not Brady material. A good deal of it could be Giglio material. There was very, very little information that was truly material exculpatory. And the question was how the case dragged on that long. And the reason is because of the defendant's aggressive motion practice. These Section 4, SEPA Section 4 hearings could have been held much earlier. They needed to be held. But it was not inevitable, and it was not correct that the defendant couldn't go to trial before 2017. If the trial had been set before that, these SEPA Section 4 hearings would have been held before that, and these decisions would have been made earlier. It's a cumbersome procedure. We have no choice. It's federal law.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. We'll consider additional time in the next case if necessary, but for now, your time is up.
Thank you.
And Judge Lucero, to answer your point earlier, I apologize for not having this information in front of me. Defense counsel first moved for production of Mr. Jumaev's statements in a written motion that was filed on September 5th, 2012. That's in volume one at page 463 of the record.
Give us that again, please. That is where?
It's volume one, page 463. And, Your Honor, that is referenced at page three of our opening brief as well. So Thank you. Once again, I apologize for not having that information earlier. The only other point I just want to emphasize briefly is, and this is something that Judge Matheson was suggesting earlier, it's important to remember that Barker talks about the reason for the delay in terms of it doesn't necessarily have to be the government's fault that it took 6 years. Barker specifically talks about neutral reasons still being charged to the government because it's the government's responsibility ultimately to bring a case to trial within the constitutional limits. And I just want to emphasize that even if this court is unwilling to say the entire delay is the government's fault or the result of some sort of negligent conduct on the government's part, that doesn't mean that there was not a Sixth Amendment violation. The fact that it took this long, if it's congestion of the courts, that's still not the defendant's fault. That's still chargeable under the Sixth Amendment analysis. And simply, 6 years and one day was too long. It's too long. And to go to the sentencing point, certainly the Barker court talks about conditions of pretrial confinement. Certainly it's relevant that Mr. Jumaev's ultimate 76-month sentence was time served. And he spent the vast majority of that, 72 of those months, in pretrial detention. And for those reasons, I'd respectfully ask that you reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Counsel are excused and the case is submitted.